Fulton Road in West Fulton. S-A-P-B-U-S-H. Sapbush.com. WIOX is supported by Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center on State Route 10 in Walton for disposal and recycling. Open 7:30 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday. Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center information about materials and disposal fees at 607-832-5800 or see the Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center link at WIOXradio.org. WIOX is supported by Chappie's Good Food Cafe in Roxbury. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner. Indoor dining, outdoor dining, pickup, delivery. Open weekdays at 12 noon, weekends at 11 a.m. With a menu designed to be eclectic with simply prepared quality ingredients. Wings, pizza, burgers, and steaks. Local smoked trout, crab cakes, and daily fish specials. Local beers and special cocktails. Chappie's Good Food Cafe, Main Street in Roxbury. Chappie'sGoodFood.com, 607-326-7020. 607-326-7020.
Hi, I'm William Duke, host of Spiritual Solutions. Alternate Monday afternoons from 1 to 2, right here on WIOX Roxbury. Community radio, live and local in New York's Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, and on MTC Cable Channel 20 and WIOXradio.org.
Good evening. You're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the Radio FM app or something like that. I can never get those things to work on my phone. Maybe it's my phone or me. I don't know. Anyway, this is From the Forest. From the Forest. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., we talk about a different forest-related topic. Usually it's Ryan and John. Ryan's out tonight. But in the studio, we have a voice you might have heard before in the past. Actually, both of you have been on in the past. It's come to find out. I didn't know Frank. Frank said he hasn't been here in years. But anyway, it's Mike Porter and Frank Winkler. Both Mike and Frank are each board of directors of the Catskill Forest Association. That's how we know them. And tonight's show, what we want to discuss and what the name of the show was, managing a family woodlot. So each of these guys have woodlots in the town of Andes, New York, in Delaware County. And coincidentally, they're pretty much right across the street, and yep. The hillsides and the trees look at each other all day, every day. So,
yeah,
these guys. Tonight we want to talk about the differences and well, we'll get into that. But basically discuss the compare and contrast the sizes of these woodlots, how they're managed differently, and what the goals and long-term thoughts are for the future. Because both of them, I think, want to manage this not just for themselves, but maybe somebody else down the line. So, anyway, let's introduce each of you. It's Mike and Frank. We'll start with Mike. Who are you?
I'm Mike Porter. I live in Margaretville. I'm president of the board of directors of CFA. I grew up in Roxbury. I have 17.7 acres of land in Andes, kind of across the road from Frank's place.
Yeah, I'm Frank Winkler, and I live in Andes. I live there full time now. I lived away for about 25 years. I work for the Department of Agriculture, Natural Resource Conservation Service for, with other work with Soil and Water District for about 40 years. So the woodlot's been in the family for close to 80 years now. And my wife and I have been owners for almost 40 at this point.
Wow. That's really nice. Impressive. Well, but your woodlot's changed. Well, I guess both of them has changed quite a bit since you've each owned them. But more so since you've seen more time with it, Frank. What would that woodlot look like when your father owned it versus what it looks like maybe today?
My father and mom, as newlyweds, bought the place back in, I think it was about 1943. They were going to be dairy farmers. There was a barn and a couple outbuildings and no house. So the first thing they did was sell the timber to get enough lumber out of, swap for lumber to build a house. And he had a bunch of his buddies come up and they framed in the house and, you know, they got three basic rooms, and the other rooms didn't get done till another child was born. And there was four of us, and that took 13 years. So it took a while for Mom to get the house she wanted. So it was harvested heavy back then, and then in the mid-50s, I can remember it being harvested once more. I kind of got into it big time through my hunting, deer hunting, spending lots of time in the woods, and when I'm deer hunting, I look at trees all the time. And there was a lot of pole-sized timber. I didn't take forestry in school. Many times I wanted to get a course, but it always conflicted with my other crop science, soil science that I was taking. But I always did a lot of reading, kept up on it. So in the early 70s, I started doing timber stand improvement, where you go in and cut the poorer quality trees out of the way so that the sunshine can get to the quality trees and grow much faster that way. So that started back in the 70s. One thing I got to mention right away is the safety aspect of it. I look back now, I'm probably lucky to be alive. You know, no hard hat, no ear protection, no chaps, no kickback protection on the chainsaw. But I got through it, luckily. And now I wouldn't think of going into the woods without all this basic safety gear. And the game of logging is a key for all of us. I took that course after 40 years of running a chainsaw. And, you know, I wasn't stupid about running a chainsaw, but I didn't know all the techniques that really should be known by anybody who's going to be running a saw, no matter how simple a task they may want to do.
What's that course again? The game of logging?
Game of logging.
Yeah. That's something that Catskill Forest Association hosts multiple times a year, and hopefully more so next year. I'd like to get a bunch of those in the books, but it definitely is it's a great course. I mean, if you're ever going to think about cutting a tree down, big or small, or even just running a chainsaw, you're going to learn a lot from that course.
It's definitely.
A nationally recognized safety course.
I know when I took the course, there were people in there who were professional loggers, and there was some people. One was a woman who basically took the chainsaw out of the box for the first time, and the instructor, you know, worked with each one of them to match their skills and bring them up to stuff with the basics.
And a lot of times, the person that's taking the chainsaw out of the box and asking where does the gas go ends up winning the course.
They don't have all those bad habits.
You get docked for safety violations all day long in the course, and that professional logger, even though he knows how to cut the tree down, usually doesn't get a good score.
Yeah.
Not always. But Mike, how has your woods changed, and when did you buy it? Let's tell you the history of your woods.
In 1987, we actually, the kids were 9 and 11 or something like that, and we decided we wanted to buy some land. I wanted a pine forest to build a cabin and a swamp. Becky wanted a view.
Naturally.
So we bought down in a hole. Found a great pine forest. Found a swamp that we ultimately turned into a pond. And now, 30-some years later, we're cutting a view. So you can sit on our porch and look out over the mountains, almost over to Frank's. And it's getting to where we both want it. But when we bought, the nearest we can figure from the age of the trees, we had 5 acres roughly of Scotch pine that was maximum 9 inches in diameter. And then another acre or so of spruce that was right above our spring. And the spring had served a farmhouse across the valley, and we found remnants of the pipe that used to go over there. So that spring was dependable. And the guy we bought the place from, I don't think knew there was a spring there. Because he wasn't getting around very well, and his daughter owned it, and we got it. But anyway, it was all, like, I don't want to say abandoned farmland, but it was farmland that was retired. The place is loaded with stone walls, and as I tell people, they didn't put stone walls in woods. They were fields at one time. So we inherited or purchased 5 acres of Scotch pine that at the time turned into our cabin, and right now is pretty close to aging out. It's pretty nice timber. So I bought the sawmill. Some of you might have heard me tell about that before. So I'm milling up pine, and it's gradually being replaced by cherry and oak and sugar maple and red maple and a lot of birch. So my woods is evolving from all pine to hardwoods. The part that was probably last pasture is mostly red maple and aspen. And it's really, and it's not a good accessible place, so I haven't done much with it yet. But that's where we are. And we did build a cabin. We put a pond in.
You built a cabin with the trees that were there.
Trees that were there, yep, we wow. did. So I got my wish, got my cabin. And I forget how many hours we did. We figured we had more hours than dollars in the cabin. And the interesting thing, because Frank and I go back quite a ways, mm-hmm. he's not quite as old as I am, but he likes to say to pick on me that I'm getting old. He's real close. Anyway, the day we were up on Dingle Hill looking for a property, we stopped, saw this guy out in the dooryard. It was Frank. He says, "You know any place around where there's surveying?" He says, "Not right offhand, but check with Dick Stocksaker. He sometimes has land to sell." So we got our tip from Frank before we really knew him.
But you knew of Frank. You know who he was.
No.
Oh, you did?
No.
So what do you think of his new neighbor moving in and cutting down trees and building the cabin?
Well, there's a couple things I wanted to cover.
Oh, let it out.
our cattle pastured on those Scotch pine plantations before they were there.
Oh, so you remember when it was grass.
Little kid. Frank is old.
I'm old.
Okay, well, this is very neat to unfold. And so Frank got to see Mike's woodlot as a pasture.
As a pasture. Grass. And then there was a land bank program in the early 60s, I don't remember exactly when, which that land was enrolled in. And they got money to plant the Scotch pine, and then it's evolved from there. But I remember Mike from being a rival on the soccer field.
Oh,
yeah, I didn't
Roxbury
remember
Roxbury Andy
Frank.
Type thing.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'm much younger, so he wouldn't remember.
Yeah.
I was 2 years behind him. But yeah. We're only.
And Frank was actually building his cabin, which is part of his whole house now, at about the same time we were building ours.
1987.
Our kids were basically the same age, so there was this path cut across the field by one of the other neighbors that allowed the kids to go back and forth to play. So
oh,
it
really?
Was. We have a pretty long-standing friendship and relationship. Yeah. And it gets to a point now where we say, well, what kind of trouble are we going to get into today? And neither of us are getting in as much trouble as we used to.
No.
That's great. So can you tell us, Frank, anything more you remember about Mike's woodlot, maybe as you saw it become a – so I guess it was abandoned by – your family farm then? Is that?
Yeah, we rented it from this older man that owned the land.
About what year did you guys pull your cows off of that spot?
I think it was the early 60s.
And then those Scotch pine would have been planted right after.
Right after that.
So yeah. Those trees were in their 20s or almost 30s when Mike moved in.
Yeah,
we were hard-pressed to get enough trees big enough to build a cabin.
Right.
Today, there is some 18, 19-inch trees.
Oh, sure.
They're beautiful.
Oh, I've seen the tree. I've even cut some of your trees.
Yeah, you
have. And they're big enough for some of them, a 20-inch bar. You got to double bore cut them.
Yeah.
You can't get a 20-inch bar through it. So that's very interesting. And, I mean, Mike has asked me, what do you think, you know, one of the first things he asked me about is Scotch pine. And I said, they're in decline. Cut them.
Yeah.
So they're aging out, for sure. Yeah. So they'll get to see their whole life cycle, Frank.
And they are big trees. Holy cow. When one of them falls, it's thunderous.
Yeah, big trees tend to. Well, this is From the Forest on WIOX 91.3 FM. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., we talk about a different forest-related topic. We've introduced Frank Winkler and Mike Porter. They own opposing woodlots to each other over in Andes, New York. We've just been discussing with them some of their the history of their woodlots, but when we come back, I want to talk about their management strategies and maybe how they differ for the future.
Shipped off far away from home, and all the two-time bankers all moan and complain. That's enough, I got enough for two, none left for me and you. And all you daytime workers, your back's breaking every day. You ain't but a passing thought in their mind, and when you're done toiling, sorry, sir, you're on your own. Don't mind this, you don't mind that, you surely won't mind dying. And the years roll down in this dusty town. It's been worn down, hard run away. Friendly, and her daddy wants me dead. That's the way things go these days, and that's the way they've been. And the years roll down in this dusty town. It's been worn down, hard run away. Of all my friends and lovers, I'm the only one left alive. It echoes through the halls and stairs and looks me in the eye. And the years roll down in this dusty town. It's been worn down, hard run away. And the years roll down in this dusty town. It's been worn down, hard run away.
This is From the Forest. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7, we talk about a different forest-related topic on WIOX Roxbury. You know, we had a listener call in and ask us if we can mention the names of some of the songs we play, because they enjoy every one. I think maybe that's a stretch. But that one was called Wrong Way Street by Trampled by Turtles. If you cared to know a bluegrass band. But anyway, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., we talk about different forest-related topic on From the Forest. And tonight we're talking about two landowners who own, I said opposing. They told me in the break that they're not opposing. Well, I meant opposing because they're on opposite sides of the hill and they're on opposite sides of the road. So they're opposing, but they're not in opposition of one another.
Right. Or competition.
Or competition. So we talked a lot about you know, how they got their woodlots, and let's talk a little more about what your goals are. What are you doing? Maybe let's start with Frank, since he's owned his woodlot for 40 years and his father before that. So what was your father's goals with his woodlot? Did he have any that he mentioned to you?
Not really. Like many dairy farmers, still to this day in many instances, they're too busy taking care of their livestock day in and day out to get awfully involved with the woods. You know, they'll make a sale periodically, but they don't really put much management into it. I know a few of them out there who've done a really good job.
Yeah. Not I don't know. Many. I tell you, some of the nicest timber I think I've ever seen was on a farmer's property, and he had not a clue about forestry, or at least he didn't lead on to. Mm-hmm. He's playing dumb, and all he did, he says, "Oh, I don't know. I just know what a firewood tree is, and this is where I cut my firewood. I've been cutting firewood here for 40 years." I tell you what, he had some beautiful saw timber that he had no intentions of ever cutting, but it just so happened that he'd been doing TSI in there. And
someday it will get cut. But that's a big thing, is knowing what trees have value from the species aspect, which ones have a higher value, usually in a commercial market, which ones retain that, which ones have good growth form. And it's hard to know sometimes if the tree has a lot of value. You may see a bad spot in it, and maybe if it's a soft maple, that rot may expand throughout the whole stem. But other trees have a ability to wall off that bad area, and they'll have a really good log. So there's a lot to it, and a lot I don't know. I do rely on my consulting forester overall for much of what I do. And they play a very important role for anybody who has a fairly large woodlot, I think, to help you manage the woodlot and manage the sales, because they do it all the time. If you're a woodlot owner, you might have one or two or maybe three sales in your lifetime even, so it's hard to know all the different aspects, what's reasonable to expect, what isn't acceptable. So a good consulting forester and a good relationship with that person is really vital for a larger woodlot owner. Doesn't mean you need to agree and just do whatever that forester says. You want to challenge them sometimes, because it may not match your management goals. I know with one of my harvests, I said, I want all my cultures marked in that harvest. I want them out of there. It was going to take him more time, probably cut into his profits a little bit, but yeah, it made sense. He did it, and it seems like in our area, the loggers never have any trouble getting rid of a load of firewood one place or another. I think the one guy probably sold 6 loads on my hill before he ever had to move further than that when he was making a harvest 30-some years or 25 years ago. And I've done a lot of research on my own. I'm active with Catskill Forest Association, some other forest associations, and I do a lot of reading. So it helped me bring my core knowledge up to where at least know enough to ask the right questions.
So did you write your own management plan then, or how have you come to understand what you need to do in your woodlot? I know you mentioned you've got some advice from a consulting forester, but is that where it all began?
Some of it began before I had a consulting forester. DEC had foresters that would come out and do mark for timber stand improvement. So, you know, you kind of watch what they're doing, and from that you can learn what trees should be saved and what should be taken out. And you just mimic that as you go on. So the consultant forester didn't have any trouble with me doing my own timber stand improvement, which saved me a bunch of money. But it was a learning process. You know, I didn't learn it overnight.
Right, right.
And I still have a lot to learn.
So you reached out to others along the way.
Yep, very much so.
How about you, Mike?
Well, first off, I have 17 acres, and when I did my inventory of trees when I first bought the place in the Scotch Pines, we cut 70% of the trees just to lay them down because they were dead. They'd been planted 6 feet apart, and they were spaced too close. So I did a lot of that. Then I went through and marked. I'd done some teaching on forestry stuff when I was teaching in high school, so I knew how to use a cruising stick and stuff like that. So I marked stuff because we were going to build a cabin. So I marked what I had, took kind of an inventory, and realized I had enough trees big enough to make the cabin. There was essentially not much in the line of hardwood in there. There was a few big wolf trees along the walls, a couple of smaller oaks, and a couple smaller maples. There was one stand of little pole wood, sapling wood of sugar maple, that we kind of said, okay, Jed, our son Jed, he loved his hatchet. Says, you can go in this section of woods and you can manage it. So he went in and picked out trees that had bad spots in them and chopped them down and made firewood, kept him busy. And twice now we've gone through and reworked that section. And if I were going to do maple syruping up there, the trees are just about ready with the new technology to be tapped. So in that 30-some years, they've grown appreciably. Ash is coming in pretty big. In fact, ash is a problem because we've got to do something with it. Cherry is, as I've been thinning lately, there's a lot of really nice cherries, probably more cherries than anything else. I don't have enough to do a commercial sale, but I do a lot of woodworking, so I'm not looking for anything more than someone to help me get a tree on the ground and I can get it to my sawmill. Or Frank would have blowdowns and I'd come over with my tractor and pick up a bunch of logs and get them sawn. Between us, we've got some pretty nice stuff out of that material.
Just for personal stock.
Yeah, personal stock. And that, as small as my lot is, my whole goal is personal. I don't look at it like I'm ever going to make anything on a commercial sale. So if I sell something, it's going to be a bench that I make out of a tree that grew there, or something I make for one of my kids that I don't make anything on. I just do it. So I have a very different outlook on what I've got. And most of the property doesn't have much that would be marketable as anything but firewood. So I cut firewood there all the time.
So you're going to turn that into the old farmer's wood lot, right?
Cutting yeah.
Firewood.
Yeah. I've left the good trees.
Good.
Yeah, and I cut firewood.
So, Frank, when did you begin your TSI, or timber stand improvement?
That would have been in 1974, that winter.
And what did the woods look like then up until... And what did they transition to up until your first commercial harvest that you saw? And when was your first commercial harvest?
Okay. They usually say when you do timber stand improvement, you know, 10 years or so, the trees will be ready. And then when you start quizzing them a little bit more, it's more like 15, 18 or something along that line. So I started, like I say, in 74, right after I got out of college, unemployed that winter. So I went into the woods, our woods, and worked. The first harvest, I think, was in 1996 or 97, just when my son was getting out of high school. And
so about a 20-year span. Then.
Yeah, it was about a 20-year span. Again, it was all managed by the consulting forester, and I went down for bid opening. and I'm not going to get the numbers just right, but I think I was expecting maybe $18,000 or something like that, and the top bid was close to $50,000. So I was pleasantly surprised.
Holy cow. And that was because timber prices were high, or you had quality trees as well?
Yeah, timber prices were good, and the trees were good. They weren't really large trees, but there was enough competition between them that we felt that it needed to be opened up a little bit, thinned out a little bit more. So that was in 96. And the next harvest, I think, was scheduled for 2014 or 13, something like that. And things were growing good. I kept doing some TSI work in other places. And then I think it was 2011, it might have been 2010, we had a very severe blowdown. And a lot of quality trees got blown over. So I went up and did a count of those trees and did a little basic measurements and handed that to the consulting forester. He says, yep, we better move that harvest up and get things out at this point in time so we don't lose the value of those trees. So we had another harvest at that point, and I don't remember the exact dollars that I got out of that. At that particular harvest, what I did, I checked with my sister, who has part of the original woodlot right next to me, about 15 acres. And I suggested to her and her husband that, you know, you got trees in there that are ready for harvest. If you want to have it all done with mine, it'll make the whole bid a little bit more attractive to have that many more trees. And also, you won't have to have a skid trail through your meadows and a landing out by your barn or whatever. They can use my landings and all. So she did that, and that worked out real good for her. I don't remember the dollar value she got now. That was about $15,000, I think. So it was beneficial for all of us to work that way.
Right.
And I think there are other opportunities where, you know, if you can work with neighbors, make them aware of what's going on, it can help. My last harvest finished up a year ago, and that was something unique. I didn't plan on cutting any more trees until, I think it was 2028, something along that line. But emerald ash borer was moving in, and I have a lot of ash. So I had to make the decision of when was a good time to go in and get those trees before their value would go downhill, and they become a hazard too, for that matter. So we went ahead. This was a little bit different than the typical consulting forester, because this was kind of a no-brainer type harvest. It was going to be all the ash tree that had commercial value. I went in and I measured every tree. I'm an amateur, I'm not a pro, but I went in and measured every tree and showed it to my consulting forester. He says, yeah, you know, you might as well just go ahead with the mill. We have a harvest on my neighbors next door, and see if that mill is interested in those trees, and the logger can move right over and take care of what you got. So that's the plan we went with. So that was on a 50-50 sale agreement. And it took 2 years for a project that I thought would take 4 or 5 weeks, because we had terribly wet years in 2018 and 2019, as many as you probably remember. So it was a little frustrating, disruptive. But finally, last year, we got all those trees out, and I got $22,000 out of it. So it was, you know, well worth my time and effort to get rid of those trees. A little sidelight to that, at the same time with all my contacts in forestry, I heard that the USDA APHIS, Animal Plant and Health Inspection Service, was looking for sites to release parasitoid wasp that hopefully will get into the emerald ash borer larvae and keep the larvae under control so that it doesn't do the devastation that it now does. And so for the last 2 years, they've been releasing those wasps on my property. You don't see them. You don't know whether they're doing
anything. That's why my trees haven't died yet.
I do have other trees driving right in the entrance of my driveway. Yeah. They're dying from that. But, you know, that's for the long haul to see what happens. Sawyer Gardner, the young lady who's heading up that project, we had on the radio here a couple years ago.
I don't even know if it's that long. Maybe
it was just last year.
Yeah, I think it was just last year. But yeah, Sawyer Gardner of APHIS, USDA.
Right. So she's continued to do that this year, and next year she's going to try to evaluate to see if they're taking hold.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep us posted on it. Maybe we'll have you and Sawyer back on one day and
could be.
Do
could
another be show, show and do an update. That would be great.
It's nice to be part of a project like that to, you know, maybe help preserve our ash trees because they are so important.
Yeah. So Frank.
I want to just add something real quick on Frank. One of the things that hasn't come up yet in terms of the family woodlot, Frank is a 480A participant, which is a tax break. So you have fairly stringent guidelines based on that, which you really haven't talked about yet. But
no.
There are advantages and disadvantages to it that maybe a larger landowner would like to hear.
Sure. I'd like to get into that, but let's hold off for just a little bit. I still want to just ask you one more question before we move on, and then I want to break apart a little bit of what you discussed. I guess what are some of the biggest changes that you've noticed that's a direct result of your work? I mean, obviously with multiple harvests, you can see the changes in the hillsides, but outside looking in, I mean, what do you take away and good and bad or neither, whatever your mind goes towards?
Harvesting trees with heavy equipment is very disruptive. It's going to change the looks of things. You're going to have tops laying here and there. You're going to have roads, access roads to get in and out. Trees along the edge of those roads are going to be bumped into. You can't avoid it. So it's disruptive, and that bothers some people. To me, it's just part of the activity that you're doing. One thing I do have, did get out of that, is about three and a half miles of trails on my 100 acres of woodlot. So I have good access most anywhere in my woods.
Sure.
And you can't really manage a woods unless you can get to it. And I can get to it with my ATV without having to walk more than 100 yards.
Sure. I know people very close to me who have had a timber sale and then that year went and bought an ATV so they can access their woods. And yeah. Those same people haven't been in the woods prior to that in a decade. And that's purely recreational. But, I mean, once you get into the woods, you start noticing, and that's the first way to manage is just to pay attention, right? And you see the differences and the changes over time. It's just not a set it, forget it kind of thing. But I guess this is a question for both of you, and maybe more so for Frank, but how has a forester helped you over time in either of your woods, and is there any advice you can give to people about choosing a forester, your experiences with foresters, and utilization of their profession?
It's an interesting question because I think there's most of them are very talented. Some of them are easier to work with than others. Somebody who I can work with well may be fine for me, but not suitable for some other people. So you want to ask around and interview, make sure they understand what your goals and objectives are, because they can make a plan and run with it, but you really want to have the input up front. So what's important to you is relayed in that message. If there are certain areas you don't want disturbed, so be it. But yeah, you want to pick somebody that you can get along with. And I've had this relationship with my forester for 40 years. He's very, very knowledgeable. I think he gets the top dollar for trees. There's certain things that, you know, we talk about, and I may insist upon him doing that he probably wouldn't do if I didn't make those requests. But, you know, he's been easy to work with for me in that respect.
Good. I mean, that's the advice I give to anybody who asks me anymore. And they always ask, well, who do you recommend? Who do you recommend? I don't give anybody any names very rarely anymore. Mm-hmm. It's usually a list of foresters. And here's a list. And I tell them, don't worry about the zip code of the phone number you're calling. Yeah. Make it an interview process and find someone you're willing to work with, because a forester should be a long-term agreement and a very long-term relationship. like you just mentioned, 4 decades now with the same forester, and find somebody that you think you can trust and you can work with, and it might even take you a year or two to find that person. And if you're going to hire a forester, you really need to have a working relationship with them.
Trust is a big thing.
Especially with a timber sale. I mean, you have a lot of dollars on the line, like you mentioned, Frank. Mm-hmm. And you might only see 1 to 3 timber sales in your lifetime of owning that woodlot. So trusting someone to be able to carry it through, but also having someone that you can pick up the phone and know who's going to answer the phone on the other end and communicate those issues over a multi-year sale. Mm-hmm. 2 years is a long time to manage a sale, and that's actually not that uncommon. Most people don't understand that. They think they're going to pick up the phone and call a forester and a logger's going to show up and cut their trees that week.
I think most contracts go for 18 months now, I think.
I've heard of longer. I've heard of 2 years with extension windows, of available extension windows.
The other thing, while we're talking about trust, the same holds true for loggers.
Sure.
You know, and most loggers are hardworking guys. They're skilled in what they're doing, or they wouldn't survive economically or for any other reason. And you really want to build a relationship with them. Show them that you care for your woodlot and you care for their well-being, and you might be able to give them a tip or two to make things more efficient on how they pull out. I've had excellent experience with all 4 loggers I had on my property. The last one I really enjoyed working with, he came over from my neighbor, as I mentioned earlier, that was harvesting over there, and he harvested mine. And then I had another neighbor above me on my hill whose property comes down the hill quite a ways behind me. And there were beautiful ash trees on that, the nicest ash trees on the hill. And so I talked to that landowner and said, you know, if you want those harvested, they could pull it out through my landing. Otherwise, they're going to have to pull it uphill almost a mile to your landing. And that really hurts the economics of it all. So he went ahead and hired that logger to do that harvest. So here we got his trees coming to my landing. Some of my trees went to his landing. I got to trust that logger that he's doing everything right. And then when it goes to the mill, you got to trust the mill that they're going to grade your trees properly and count everyone, and you get payment for it. So there's you got to have some trust all the way through and do some research and know the reputation of the different places. There's some guys out there that I think you want to avoid when you start talking around, but most of them, I think, are pretty honest, hardworking people.
Well, sure, like you said, especially in the Catskill Mountains, there's a lot of small communities, and word of mouth spreads. If there's someone doing bad business, there's other ways that they're not going to survive in the business world. Mm-hmm.
The other thing we didn't mention is deer. Always got to get back to deer. Of course, Ryan's not here, but you know, he'd be disappointed if we didn't talk about it.
Well, it would be unique if we didn't talk about it.
That's right.
Virtually every radio show, deer come up.
And I, like most forest owners, have a love-hate relationship with deer. I'd love to see them out in the woods. I really enjoy that, or out in the fields in front of my house. Every night I go out and look and see who's out there. But too many deer are a problem. I do hunt them. I do enjoy hunting. It's a real social thing with my family. I took my grandson out for the first time this year during the early hunt for 14-year-olds, and I had a great time. He was a little disappointed he didn't get anything, but I had a great time. So it's a tradition we try to keep up. And we have to keep the deer population under control, especially after a heavy harvest like I had with the ash trees coming out, because we need to get that next generation of trees started. We got to get them up to saplings where they're 6-8 feet tall, and the deer aren't going to munch them back to the ground every year. So for the next 2 years, for 3 years now, I'm going to harvest extra deer to keep the population low for a little while, so my woodlands have a chance to rebound. So I'm in the process of doing that. I have to work with DEC to, you know, get those permits.
I was going
to
say, you said extra deer. Does that mean that you somehow can acquire a
deer management assistance program they have? I think you have to have at least 50 acres. But they want to see a lot more. So I work with my neighbors. You know, they don't hunt. They allow me to hunt. That's one of the advantages I have. And they signed up with me so we could have 4 extra tags to take antlerless deer with over the next 3 years.
Wow. Yeah. And for, Mike, do you you have anything to say about deer on your side of the valley?
Oh, they're there. We had a doe this summer that bedded down between two of my lumber piles. All summer, she was there. And I come up on my tractor and drive by her and say hello and come around the sharp turn and pull into the sawmill. And she wouldn't budge till I got off the tractor. And then she just walked away. And then we had a doe and two fawns and a doe and a fawn that were right around there also. We haven't seen them since late August, but they're there. And we were watching them browse. We could look at the plants they were eating, and you can see there's not much of any quality growing. Since we bought the place, when we went around and walked, we found one beech tree, and it was down over the bank towards the stream, and it was a big tree. And Becky and I made note of it because we didn't see beech anywhere. Right now, we have beech brush hell. And one day, Frank and I went out to try to help control that. And since Becky and I have been going out to control it with a little very spotted, using Roundup-like stuff. And we also had striped maple come in. But when we first bought, it was just pines. As they died off and we thinned them, got more light on the ground, and it's amazing how much beech is in there. And, they had to have been there as a seed crop, and how long it sat without growing, I don't know. And the same with the striped maple. So we've got those two species that we have to control, and we have black birch. And there was someone on, I think it was last week, maybe Gary or somebody was talking about black birch as a problem tree. And I'm not going to treat it as a problem tree because someday somebody might want to make birch syrup with those trees.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, like it or not, black birch is coming into the Catskills at enormous rates. So
we have a lot of it.
Another generation beyond us is going to have a lot of black birch to harvest if they're interested. So hopefully there's a good use that's out there.
Well, Gary had said that it doesn't, you cut it and it doesn't sucker, unlike the beech and the
it doesn't maple. Doesn't root sucker, or stump sucker so bad, really.
Yeah. So if it's cut and managed, it might stay down. The beech and the striped maple really come in.
Yeah, black birch comes in with just a little bit of disturbance, and it can tolerate a lot of shade. So if you're in a dark canopy, like maybe you were at one time, Mike, and just cut one tree out of there, that's just enough sunlight and just enough disturbance that black birch can make it, but other things might not be able to. Like you wouldn't be able to regenerate a red oak or something like that.
The beech is frustrating.
Yeah, how was it on your side of the valley?
I have certain spots on my hill that are nasty. I've done quite a bit of control.
Yep.
But there's always more to do.
Seems like it, huh?
Yeah. The other thing I do for the deer is I plant a lot of apple trees, and also my skid trails, and especially the landing, I seed. In the woods, this is the agronomist to me, I do creeping red fescue, which is very tolerant to shade. Doesn't get very tall, so you can walk through it without being tripped. And I always throw a little clover, especially in the openings, I use red clover. And the deer have been feeding on that all fall now.
I'll vouch for that seed mix. I got it from Frank, and I used it after the timber sale on our family property. And it's still growing, still looks good, and wildlife still eats it.
I got just a little story to tell about the clover. We're in the process of shutting down our garden and converting some of it to lawn and going to raised beds. And the reason we're going to raised beds is because of critters. We have deer, woodchucks, they're right in the village, rabbits, all sorts of stuff. So what's Becky plant? Sorry, Becky. She plants clover. I said, Becky, what are you doing?
Attracting him further.
She's attracting him further. So sorry, Becky. I had to bring it up because we're planting clover at camp also where it's, we have apples, we have blueberries, we have, she's tried gooseberries. We don't have any white pine around, so it seems to be kind of safe to be able to put some gooseberries in. But we're in total competition with the animals. We don't hardly get anything. But I guess until the trees get bigger and we get more ambitious and they start fruiting better, we're not going to get much.
Right. Well, this is From the Forest. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., we talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight, we're talking to Mike and Frank about their woodlots. These guys own woodlots in Andes, New York, across the street from one another. But Frank, Mike brought it up that you're in a program that kind of maybe alters or forces you to manage your woodlot in a certain way. Can you talk about that a little bit? We only got about 8 minutes left.
Yeah, it's designed to give you a tax break if you're managing your woods for the long haul for timber.
What is that program?
That's 480A.
480A tax law.
It gives you an 80% reduction on the school and property tax on the forested acreage that's eligible for enrollment. I have 100 acres of woods. I have 93 acres that qualify. And for my particular situation, I save about $2,500 a year in taxes. So it's substantial. But I have to follow a plan. That plan costs $500 or something like that. It has to be updated at this point every 5 years. I have to do the timber stand improvement when it's called for. I have to harvest when it's called for. If I convert that land to something else while there's still this 10-year requirement on it, I end up paying a substantial penalty. So you don't want to do that. But if you know what you want to do and you want to manage it for timber for the long haul, it's a beneficial program. Also, I should mention when you have a sale, 6% of that stumpage fee goes to the county for taxes at that point in time. So I found it beneficial. I made my neighbor aware of this program. He has, I think, maybe 80 acres of land. He's a city guy and a city wife. They don't do any work in the woods, but they've stuck with it right along. They use the same forester I do, and he's happy with the program under his circumstances.
Right, and when you do a harvest, I mean, the timber's yours, so you've mentioned earlier in the show that you profit off that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Have you ever figured that out? You should have kept a journal all these 40 years of how many hours you've spent in the woods.
Oh, my goodness.
And figure out how much you got paid for in savings for those dollars per hour. You think it'd be in the single digits or teens, 20s, or hundreds?
I ain't worth much.
Not much, eh?
No. But you know when you do that TSI, it's just hard work. But I would frequently do it this time of year or early winter. This time of year, the deer come in and browse off those tops. In the winter, they do the same thing, so they're getting a much easier meal. So that gives me some satisfaction.
Sure.
Also, I'm a little unique, too, compared to Mike. I had mainly a northeast exposure. So it's cold up there in the wintertime, and if it snows much, the snow usually stays there. They go down on Mike's property. So
yeah,
I
we
don't
have
get some
Betty
of that heavy browse in the winter, I think, compared to what I could happen to have, though the last few years we haven't had that much snow anyway.
So. Yeah, I tend to drop a few soft maples for next year's firewood in the late fall and just let them lay. And you can cut them, and when you come back, when the snow's on the ground, you find the tracks, and there's not a bud left or a twig end left.
Oh, and sometimes they're eaten to like a quarter inch or more.
Yeah.
Like
so
they're eating,
you know,
wood fiber.
It's helping the deer, but it's also making you cut firewood, or getting you to cut firewood.
Yep. Yeah, I lay down firewood that time of year. I got it down to a science for, well, maybe not. But a pole-sized red maple forest, you can get usually about, they're in the 40 to 60-foot tall range, 8 to 12 inches in diameter. You can do about 8 trees per cord if you're cutting your firewood for the deer. I do the same thing, Mike. I cut when the snow's deep. I don't really pick a date, but when the snow gets deeper and I feel sorry for the deer, I'll go up and cut 8 trees per cord and cut my firewood and maybe spread it out over 1 to 3 weeks and let the deer have their way and eat it, and then I'll go back in April when the snow's gone and go collect.
It's amazing how fast they come in.
Sometimes they're there while you're still cutting.
Yeah, they hear that saw and
they
say, here comes snack time.
Yeah. Well, with just a few minutes left, maybe ask both of you, what's maybe your most rewarding moment you can think of, if there is one, and you've owned your woods each for 20, 30, 40 years?
It's a long process, you know. I don't think there's any one thing. Right at this point in time, I really enjoy getting on the ATV with my grandchildren. You know, they're from, what, 9 to 14 years of age, and just riding through the woods and see what we're seeing. And I'm explaining one thing or another. I'm probably boring them to death a little bit. I remember going up with my oldest grandson about 3 years ago. He's probably 11 years old. And I came up to this vernal pool, and I was explaining how the value of that vernal pool is for frogs and other amphibians. They need that water space, and they need the space that's away from fish because the fish will eat them. And I don't know all that much about it, but enough I could talk. So, and I'm explaining all this to him, and, you know, he's listening. And then I look up, and there's a bear listening to me about 60 feet away.
All right.
You know, so that made it all worthwhile for him, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's great.
So those are the memories, things you really remember a lot.
So the memories along the way.
Yeah.
I think with me, you know, it's when I drive down into our cabin area, I look at that cabin and I say, holy crap, we built that. You know, the kids were 9 and 11. They could hook up a choker. They could strip a log. I ran the chainsaw. We built that thing with our own sweat equity. And people come and say, man, what a Shangri-La.
It is a nice cabin.
It is a neat place.
And so to me, that's the big thing. But now I'm starting to see some of the possibilities with the lumber. I've got cut some nice stuff. I've made some neat things. I'm not afraid to dry wood. I'm not afraid to cut it. Sorry, Becky. I guess Becky says, why don't you use it? I says, well, I don't have time yet. I still haven't cut enough.
I go to the local lumber shop over at Mike's every now and then.
So does Frank.
Yeah,
we ended up attempting to get in trouble the other day, trying to pull a board out of a pile. Because neither of us were strong enough to do it, so the ATV with the winch
ripped it right out.
Yeah, but the evolution of the woods has been amazing. We used to have lots of pine forest or evergreen forest birds. Today, the canopy is a spotty evergreen, and we've lost some of those species, like the black-throated green warbler. They're all over the place, and now you very rarely hear them.
That's because the woods have changed.
Yeah, exactly. And part of it's been what we've done. Part of it's what's happened.
Well, that's a good place to leave, and everybody, for the listeners out there, the woods aren't static. I had a long consultation with someone recently, and the first thing I asked them when I asked their goals, and they say, well, I want to keep this the way it is for as long as I own it. I said, well, you're going to have to work really, really hard and cut a lot of trees to keep this anywhere close. And they were taken back, and I told them they had to cut trees to make it stay the same. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Killed another hour, but this is From the Forest. Every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., we talk a different forest-related topic. Tonight, we talked about managing a family woodlot with Frank Winkler and Mike Porter. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.
His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay, and he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear upon his mantle shining, face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name, and then he heard the joyful sound of children at their game, in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river